You have been listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Mark Newman from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall share with you information from various medical sources. Milk of magnesia relieved jock itch. Question. And this is People's Pharmacy. Question. For about 3 years, I had a chronic problem with jock itch. First, I tried many over-the-counter products, but none worked. My physician dismissed the problem by telling me that it was a seasonal allergy. Despite my protests, it lasted all year long. Then my urologist and dermatologist each prescribed products that gave no more than limited temporary help. A recent People's Pharmacy article mentioned milk of magnesia for jock itch. I bought a store's private label Mo-M, applied it after my shower, and was stunned with the almost instant relief. My only dissatisfaction was the very liquid form of Mo-M. Answer, jock itch, or tinea cruis, is caused by fungal overgrowth on areas of the skin that get warm and moist. The itchy rash is not limited to athletes nor to men. It can occur on the inner thighs, buttocks, genitals, and even under the breasts, which is called intertrigo. Antifungal creams are the usual recommendation. Some people have been able to control jock itch by washing the area with a dandruff shampoo containing selenium sulfide, such as Selsun Blue. Another popular remedy is applying old-fashioned amber Listerine to the rash. Be careful, though. The alcohol can sting if the skin is irritated. I would like some information on using melatonin as a sleeping aid. Will it work for people traveling long distances? Are there any side effects I should know about? I am traveling to Europe this summer. Answer. Melatonin has been used for the jet lag that can occur when a person travels over several time zones, cited in Travel Medicine and Infectious Disease, January through March 2008. Occasionally, people taking melatonin will develop a skin reaction, quote, fixed drug eruption, unquote. This should be a signal not to take it again. People on oral anticoagulants and those with epilepsy should take melatonin only under their doctor's supervision, and that's cited in BMJ Clinical Evidence online, April 29, 2014. Melatonin seems to be otherwise safe for short-term use, such as for jet lag, cited in Clinical Drug Investigation, March 2016. Question. You've written about putting keys on the back of the neck to stop nosebleeds. That makes the issue sound mysterious, but it really isn't. Keys are commonly cold. I was taught in medical school to apply a cold face towel, preferably with ice cubes, at the back of the head or even directly on the nose. This usually works. The common element is cold. We have heard from many people that dangling keys down the back of the neck can help stop a nosebleed. These reports mostly date from a time when keys, even car keys, were made of metal and would usually be cold. What can a mosquito magnet do? Question. Recently, I was out in the backyard for about 15 minutes with my grandkids. I ended up with two large swollen bites that itched and kept me awake for a couple of nights. No one else out there was bitten. This happens to me every year. I attract mosquitoes, and then I seem to be hypersensitive to the bites. Any advice? Someone like you, who is especially attractive to mosquitoes, should apply repellent before going outside. DEET, D-E-E-T, is effective, but if you prefer something else, oil of lemon, eucalyptus, and picaridin, which is spelled P-I-C-A-R-I-D-I-N, picaridin, also work to ward off mosquitoes. Once bitten, our best advice is to try heat. Hot tap water for a second or two can stop itching for a few hours. Some people use a brief application of a metal spoon that has been submerged in hot water. Be careful not to burn your skin. A third option is a battery-operated device that heats the skin around the bite. We know of two brands, Therapic and Bite Helper. Such gadgets are especially helpful when you are away from home and don't have ready access to hot water. Question. I was diagnosed at 16 with hyperthyroidism. My doctor treated it with radioactive iodine, which immediately made me hypothyroid. So hyperthyroidism is high levels. Hypo is below. As I have gotten older, I've never been able to get a doctor to adjust my meds to make me feel good. As long as my blood tests are within the normal range, they say everything's fine. Do you have any information on treating hypothyroidism? Answer, there is some controversy about the normal range for TSH, which is thyroid-stimulating hormone. This compound is produced by the brain to regulate thyroid activity. It is used as the primary measure of thyroid function, but it's not the only way to assess how well the thyroid gland is doing. Some doctors also test for T4, T3, and reverse T3. A test for TPO, thyroid peroxidase antibodies, will reveal if a person has Hashimoto's, which is an autoimmune thyroid condition. The patient's clinical symptoms are also important. That's cited in BMC, Endocrine Disorders, April 18, 2019. There is even more controversy over treating hypothyroidism. Many people do just fine on the usual prescription, T4, which is levothyroxine. But others report feeling better if they also get some T3, which is triiodothyronine. This may be especially relevant for people like you who have no functioning thyroid gland, cited in European Thyroid Journal, July 2012. And then this is to continue from last week's discussion from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter on asthma. Asthma that is not well controlled with daily inhaled corticosteroids combined with long-acting bronchodilators may benefit from medications that control inflammation in the airways linked to a certain type of white blood cell. These drugs, including Nucala, N-U-C-A-L-A, Fasenra, F-A-S-N-E-R-A, Cinquair, C-I-N-Q-A-I-R, and Dupixent, D-U-P-I-X-E-N-T, are given by injection every month or two. Other drugs, such as oral corticosteroid medication, may be added for severe asthma that occurs throughout the day and causes significant limitations despite daily treatment. Work with your doctor to develop a detailed plan for taking medications, which to take, how much, and how often, as well as which to take when symptoms begin to escalate. Create an asthma action plan for what to do to manage an asthma attack. Store the plan in a place that you and your loved ones can easily reference. Other important actions. While medications play a critical role in your asthma management, they're just one piece of the puzzle. Additional actions you can take to ensure you gain control of the condition include, 1, controlling triggers. Make an effort to minimize your exposure to environmental triggers such as animal dander, dust, or smoke. Since exercise is often a trigger but also part of a healthy lifestyle, ask your doctor about using your quick relief inhaler before exercise to avoid triggering symptoms. Next, monitoring your symptoms. Your doctor may recommend that you keep a record of your symptoms. This will help you determine if the condition is kept under control. You may also be advised to monitor your symptoms with a peak flow meter. This is a handheld device that measures how hard you can exhale air. Lower readings may be a sign that your asthma is getting worse. Thirdly, getting vaccinated. If you have asthma, you're at increased risk of developing infections. An annual flu vaccine is important, as are recommended vaccines to prevent whooping cough, which is pertussis, shingles, and pneumococcal diseases such as pneumonia and bacterial meningitis. Finally, seeing your doctor. Asthma often changes over time. So too can the level of treatment you need. See your doctor regularly, as often as every 2 to 6 weeks, while gaining control of the symptoms to make any needed treatment adjustments. Talk with your doctor about completing the asthma control test at least annually. There are 6 preferred steps for medication management. First is called intermittent asthma. That's when you use a short-acting beta agonist, a SABA, S-A-B-A, as needed. Step 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 all come under persistent asthma treatments that are to be combined with rescue medication as needed. Step 2 is low-dose inhaled corticosteroids. Step 3 is low-dose inhaled corticosteroids plus inhaled long-acting beta agonists or medium-dose inhaled corticosteroids. Step 4, medium-dose inhaled corticosteroids plus LABA, which is the long-acting beta agonist. 5 is high-dose ICS plus LABA. And 6 is high-dose ICS plus LABA plus oral corticosteroids. Health tips. Ladder safety. Whether you're dusting above the cabinets or cleaning the gutters, a ladder may be just the tool you need. But each year, hundreds of thousands of people seek treatment for ladder-related injuries. Some tips for safely navigating a ladder. Number 1, safeguard from the start. Excuse me. Guard doorways and block any high traffic areas to reduce the chance of a collision. Be mindful of weather conditions that may make outdoor ladder use hazardous, such as rain or high winds. Next, set a strong foundation. Set the ladder on a firm, flat, and even surface. If you must use the ladder on a soft surface, try placing a board underneath. Thirdly, angle appropriately. A straight or extension ladder should be placed 1 foot away from the surface it's resting against for every 4 feet of the ladder's height. 4, climb carefully. Face the ladder while climbing and maintain 3 points of contact, either 2 hands and a foot or 2 feet and a hand. Grip the rungs, not the side rails. And don't climb with items in your hands. Wear shoes with good traction. 5th, stop before the top. Don't stand on the top of the step ladder. With straight or extension ladders, avoid going higher than the 3rd rung from the top. 6th, avoid leaning and overreaching. Get down and reposition the ladder instead. And finally, ask for help. If you're not feeling steady, request help with completing the task or hire someone to get the job done. First aid for choking. Quick action to save a life. Choking is frightening. Most of the time, coughing is enough to dislodge or expel the object blocking the throat or larynx or windpipe, trachea, and restore full airflow to the lungs. However, choking can quickly become an emergency situation if the airway isn't cleared and normal breathing restored. It's not always obvious when someone is choking, particularly with older adults. One clue to choking in an adult is that it typically occurs while eating. Choking commonly occurs when eating a piece of meat, but older adults appear more susceptible to choking on softer foods such as a bite of a sandwich, a meatball, fruit, vegetable, or noodles. In many cases, a morsel of food may go down the wrong pipe, and the coughing reflex may take care of the problem. Still, keep an eye on the person, particularly if he or she moves to a more private location. Ask, "Are you choking?" The person can talk, cough freely, and has normal skin color, he or she isn't choking. Panic is often the first response of someone who is choking. When you ask about choking, the person may nod without speaking, or try to communicate with hand motions. Additional indications of choking include difficulty, breathing or wheeziness, gasping or gurgling while breathing, the inability to cough forcefully or a silent cough, loss of consciousness or blue or dusky skin, lips and nails. If you're the one choking and there are bystanders, make the universal signal for choking by clutching your hands to your throat. Quick action. If an adult or child over age 1 is choking with a completely blocked airway but conscious, take action by giving the 5 back blows. To do so, stand to the side and just behind a choking adult. For a child, lean down behind the child, place one arm across the chest for support. Bend the person over at the waist and deliver 5 separate back blows between the person's shoulder blades with the heel of your hand. Giving abdominal thrusts, which is the old Heimlich maneuver. If you give back blows and the object doesn't dislodge, move to this step. It's also okay to start with abdominal thrusts. To perform them, stand behind the person and wrap your arms around the waist. With a small child, kneel down beside the child. Make a fist with one hand. Position it slightly above the person's navel. Grasp the fist with the other hand. For someone who's pregnant or obese, place your hands higher at the base of the breastbone, just above the joining of the lowest ribs. Press hard into the abdomen with a quick upward thrust as if trying to lift the person up. If it's a smaller child, be careful not to use too much force. Perform between 5 and 10 abdominal thrusts until the blockage is dislodged. Lost consciousness. If you're unable to quickly dislodge an object from the throat, or if a person loses consciousness, call 911 or your local emergency number. If there's a loss of consciousness, get the person on his or her back and, number one, clear the airway if possible. If a blockage is visible at the back of the throat or high in the throat, reach a finger into the mouth and sweep it out the cause of the blockage. However, if you can't see the object, don't try the finger sweep. Be careful not to push the food or object deeper into the airway, which can easily happen in young children. Secondly, begin cardiopulmonary resuscitation or CPR chest compressions if the object remains lodged and the person doesn't respond after you take the above measure. The chest compressions may dislodge the object. Remember to recheck the person's mouth periodically. And then if you're alone and choking, call 911 or your local emergency number immediately. Even if you can't speak, emergency responders know something is wrong and will follow up. Then you can perform abdominal thrusts on yourself, placing a fist on your midsection slightly above your navel, grasping your fist with the other hand and bending over a hard surface such as a chair back or countertop, pulling your fist inward and upward on your body. Stroke rehabilitation, paving the way to recovery. Every 40 seconds, someone in the United States has a stroke, even when not deadly. A stroke can change your life in an instant. A stroke affects brain tissue and may impact your ability to move, speak, see, swallow, and process or recall information. Once you've been stabilized after a stroke, the focus shifts to recovery. A critical component of your care after a stroke is a rehabilitation program. Inside a program, it's estimated that more than 2/3 of people who survive a stroke receive rehab or rehabilitation services after they've left the acute hospital. While strokes that result from a blood clot, which is called an ischemic stroke, are the most common and therefore most seen in the rehab process, these services are just as important for people who have experienced strokes caused by blood vessel rupture, such as a hemorrhagic stroke. Stroke rehab is a multifaceted program designed to boost your recovery and help you navigate your way back to independence. The services provided including physical and occupational therapy, speech and language therapy, recreational therapy, fitness instruction, nutritional care, and mental health counseling are targeted to the impairments you've experienced from the stroke. The program will direct you through focused, repetitive practice to help you recover lost abilities. You may also learn ways to adapt to lingering impairments so they're less limiting, learning to use a non-dominant hand or a mobility aid. For example, rehabilitation services may help you improve cognitive skills with memory or problem solving, and communication skills with speaking, writing, listening, and comprehension. Mobility skills, including walking with or without support aids or operating a wheelchair. Self-care skills such as feeding, grooming, and dressing. Social skills, swallowing and eating abilities. The recovery of skills required to return to work or return to driving also may be addressed, usually in the outpatient rehab setting. It's common for rehabilitation services to last 3 to 4 months after a stroke. Facility options. Rehabilitation services may take place in a number of settings. Some rehabilitation, such as working on mobility and self-care skills, will likely begin before you leave the hospital. Before you're discharged, you and your loved ones will work with your care team and hospital social workers to determine the best rehabilitation setting for your needs. Options include inpatient rehabilitation facilities. In these facilities, a team of therapists, nurses, doctors, and care coordinators typically determines your care. You must be able to participate in therapy for a specific amount of time, usually 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, in order to qualify. Other criteria for admission include the need for 24-hour rehabilitation, nursing, and regular follow-up with a rehabilitation doctor. Medicare may cover up to 90 days of services. However, people often don't meet the inpatient rehabilitation requirements for this length of time, and length of stay is determined on an individual basis. Deductibles and coinsurance costs vary, as does private and secondary insurance coverage. Next, skilled nursing facilities. If you don't meet the criteria for inpatient rehabilitation, a skilled nursing facility that has a coordinated rehabilitation program may provide services along with nursing care. Medicare usually covers up to 100 days of services in a skilled nursing facility, although after a certain period of a copay may be required. Long-term care facilities, such as a nursing home. These facilities provide basic nursing care and assistance for people who need help with daily activities. Services are generally paid out of pocket or with long-term care insurance. Medicare and most private health insurance plans don't provide coverage. Finally, home health or outpatient services. If you're discharged from the hospital directly to your home, you'll likely be able to obtain services through outpatient rehabilitation or from a home health agency if you're homebound. Home health and outpatient services are separate benefits covered by insurance. Both may be used, but not at the same time. Medicare and many private insurance companies put limits on the number of outpatient therapy sessions they'll cover. Questions to ask. The questions you can ask help guide you and your loved ones through the decision-making process. Here are some starting suggestions to ask at the hospital. What types of rehab care will my Medicare insurance cover? Where does rehab occur? What therapy programs are available to me? To ask your hospital care team before discharge, what brain areas have been affected? What types of services are likely to improve outcomes? What symptoms do you anticipate will improve? To what extent will I be able to engage in rehab activities? What should I do to reduce the chance of having another stroke? And then finally, to ask rehab providers, is the facility certified to take care for people who've had a stroke? How many rehab services can I receive, and how long will it last? How intense are the rehab services? Are medical services available? What outcomes are typical for survivors of strokes similar to mine? News and our views. Migraine prevention medications, a new era. A new era of specific migraine treatments is dawning. Advancing research is unraveling many of the complex pathways that can contribute to migraines. This has provided new targets for therapy, including a protein called calcitonin, gene-related peptide, CGRP, that's released during a migraine attack. In 2018, three similar medications, erenumab, which is Aimovig, big, Fremanezumab, which is Ajovy, A-J-O-V-Y, and Galcanezumab, which is Emgality, were approved by the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, to reduce monthly headaches days through the reduction of CGRP activity. In numerous studies involving many people, mostly people with frequent migraine and migraines and limited treatment options, about 40% to 50% of those taking these drugs experience at least a 50% reduction in migraine frequency. Put another way, for people with 12 migraines a day, or 12 migraine days a month, there was about a 50% chance that the drug reduced this to 6 or fewer monthly migraines. Not everyone responds to these drugs, but some people had a more dramatic response than described above. The medications are injected beneath the skin monthly or quarterly. So far, the main side effect appears irritation at the site of injection, with constipation as a potential side effect of erenumab, which is Aimovig, in some patients. Mayo Clinic migraine experts are using these medications in people with frequent and debilitating migraine attacks. They emphasize that CGRP inhibitors only target one pathway of a complex brain disease and won't be helpful for everyone. However, they're excited to have an expanded toolbox for migraine treatment with tools specifically designed for the job. Weight may impact effectiveness of aspirin therapy. Doctors commonly recommend daily therapy with low-dose aspirin to prevent first or recurrent heart attacks and strokes, but a new study shows that your weight may be an important factor of the effectiveness of aspirin therapy. The study published in August of 2018 in Lancet looked at data from 9 clinical trials on aspirin used to prevent an initial heart attack or stroke, a practice known as primary prevention, while low-dose aspirin of 75 to 100 milligrams a day proved effective for these. For those at lower weight, standard doses of 300 to 325 reduced cardiovascular risk in people weighing 154 pounds or more. High doses of 500 milligrams or more reduced cardiovascular risk in people weighing about 198 pounds or more. Analyzing the data on aspirin's role in preventing a subsequent heart attack or stroke, which is secondary prevention, yielded similar results. Let me remind you that you have been listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And we have run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138 and stay healthy.